The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disorders of Hemostasis is presented by Dr. Cheryl Kowalski.
So we always think of hemophilia and von Willebrand's. So with hemophilia, there is a defect in the thrombin propagation phase of coagulation. So the tests that we get, bleeding time, which that's rarely done anymore, is normal. The only thing that's abnormal is your PTT and your factor VIII. So your von Willebrand factor and your risdiplam cofactor should be totally normal. So when you think about the levels that you see there, mild is 6% of your factor, and you think about those patients rarely have bleeding problems. Moderate could be 1 to 5%, and they can have some more bleeding problems like with surgery or severe injuries. And the only ones that are bleeding heavily are ones that have less than 1%. The body is really resilient and able to compensate for these low levels. So these are when you usually see bleeding. So the less than 1% is the one that have spontaneous bleeding. Usually those are on prophylactic factor replacement. So you're going to see mucocutaneous bleeding, all these bleeding in all this area. Sometimes new patients are diagnosed at the time of birth with different procedures that they might have done or after a dental procedure. So they have factor replacement. Upon occasion, the more mild ones can have DDAVP. Imicar is given after a surgical procedure for about 5 days, starting at about day 2 or 3, because it's at day 5 you start having the lysis of your clot. And all these patients really should be cared for lifelong in a bleeding disorder clinic. So acquired is one you may see in the hospital, and they start bleeding after surgery. So that's usually when they get diagnosed. And it's usually from an inhibitor. Some can be spontaneous, but some can be from underlying issues in postpartum state, autoimmune disease, malignancy, or drug reaction. So acquired, most of them are going to need transfusions, and a lot of them can die from this. So they have to have the appropriate activated factor products because they have to bypass that antibody that they've developed. And so the treatment then, once you get them through that, is attempt suppression of that inhibitor. Von Willebrand's, so those usually will present with mucocutaneous bleeds, nosebleeds, heavy periods. The young girls start their menses and they're having a lot of heavy bleeding, tonsillectomies. So when I go for a history on von Willebrand's, because usually the hemophilia, they're diagnosed at a very much younger age, I want to know about heavy menses. Minor procedures, and I never like to say anything is minor, but dental extractions and tonsillectomies, people die from tonsillectomies. So those are the histories I get. And if they said they had dental extraction, had to go back a couple times to the dentist to get it packed, that's a good clue that they could have a bleeding disorder. So of course, the family history, and some of these may not have a family history. And then it's usually autosomal dominant, and the bleeding can be just mild. So the diagnosis is with the factor VIII activity, von Willebrand antigen, and risdiplam cofactor. And those are the ones you first look at. Once you identify that those are low, then you'd go on further to do the platelet function assay, the risdiplam induce platelet aggregation and the von Willebrand multimers to kind of more define what kind of von Willebrands you have. So there's type 1, type 2, and type 3. So you got a partial deficiency, a qualitative defect, or a total deficiency. And this is, you don't need to memorize this. This is just good for you to have for a resource to go back and look at this. So treatment is DDAVP. Most patients will respond to. The more severe ones might need factor. Again, they might require Amicar, and again, severe types should be cared for in a bleeding disorder clinic. The mild ones may take many testings to identify because they can go in and out of a low level up into a low normal level all the time, and you have to get their tests while they're actually bleeding because the next day they could be in a normal range. So sometimes they can be really hard to diagnose. In literature, one case it took them 8 testings to identify that the patient had a mild von Willebrand's. So now we'll go to the other end of the spectrum, thrombosis, so pathological blood clotting. So think about our hypercoagulable states, which are many, and the biggest thing is advancing age, and you think patients are less sedentary, and then they get obese, and then they might be on hormone replacement, and then they might have other issues with trauma and surgery, and then they're more bed confined, and all those things add up to it, blood clots. So when we think about inherited ones, all of these can really increase the thrombosis over the general population. So who should we test? So if they're 70 or 80 years old and they've just had their first blood clot, those people really don't need to be tested. So usually if they're under the age of 50, they've had a recurrent thrombosis, a family history, especially if they've had an MI or CVA at young age in their family. If they've had venous thrombosis or portal mesenteric or mesenteric vein thrombosis, think about those. And then if they've had pregnancy loss in the second or third trimester. So you don't need to test the patient who's over 50 with a first spontaneous blood clot, those with active cancer. Elderly patients, especially post-op, you don't need to test retinal vein or arterial thromboses. Women who are on birth control pills and have no family history of blood clots. So your workup is your prothrombin gene mutation, and that's the 5 Leiden, antithrombin 3, protein C activity, protein S assay, total and free, test for the antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, which is the lupus anticoagulant, and anticardiolipin antibody, which are the most common. The beta 2 glycoprotein 1 antibodies are pretty rare. So I would just go back and say one thing here. You don't need to get these testing while the patient is in the hospital. Save your hospital thousands of dollars on each patient because they're not going to get reimbursed for it as an inpatient. You know, they're all there on DRGs. It's not going to change your treatment at the immediate time. Do the testing 4 to 6 weeks after they're out of the hospital. Now, if they're on Lovenox, then you can't check the antithrombin 3. Big deal. You've got the other ones. If they're on warfarin, you can't check the protein C or protein S. Again, that's not an issue. You can get that down the road if they ever happen to be off the anticoagulation. But this is a big deal in the era of cost containment. We've really got to save our hospitals, so don't order it while they're in the hospital. So our old treatment, heparin, and then conversion, warfarin can start the first day. Remember, it's going to take more than 3 days. It takes 96 hours to get all your factor levels down with Coumadin, warfarin. And so it doesn't help to double load them the first couple days because you may drop out your lower factors quicker, and then you could actually increase your risk of bleeding. And then treatment depends on what the thrombosis is. So the direct oral anticoagulants, or NOACs is another term we've used, those are the most common ones that we see. Please know your drug and know what it can't do and what it can do, and know what your patient's insurance will cover. A lot of the patients are seen in the emergency room. They're given a sample pack for this. A week later, they go to their pharmacy to get more, and their insurance company won't pay for it. So make sure you know that, and that they're going right to see their family doctor the next day, if you're an emergency room doc. So when not to use these? They're seductive, let's face it. You don't need to have them going in 3 times a week to get their INR done. There is no testing for these, and so we don't know what the bioavailability is in these medications in a lot of patients. So these are guidelines to tell you when not to use them. So pregnancy, cancer, there's still some studies that may come out and say that they're just as good as Lovenox, but right now we're still using Lovenox in thrombosis associated with cancer. Obese patient greater than 275 pounds or frail patients less than 100 pounds. Renal dysfunction, do not use it with a creatinine clearance of less than 30 and with great hesitation when it's 30 to 40. If you have patients that have major medical interactions with other medications, they could have one with this, so be careful when you use this. And then with difficult patients, we all have them, probably at least half the patients that we anticoagulant are non-compliant, so be careful when you're using this medication. And what should be on here with frail patient is fall risks. If they're fall risk, do not use this medication. So the duration of treatment. So if it's the first one, it's a DVT, transient risk factor, maybe 3 months. Second, unprovoked, then you got to think about, does this patient need to be on long term? If they have any hypercoagulable state that you've tested for, like they've got prothrombin gene mutation or antithrombin 3, that's difficult, and it just depends on where your what your thrombosis was. Lupus anticoagulant is the most thrombogenic of all your hypercoagulable states, and it is suggested that they should stay on anticoagulation until that's negative. So you don't give them the diagnosis with your first testing if it's positive. You recheck it 3 months later. If it's still positive, they have the diagnosis, and they really should stay on anticoagulation. It used to be, up till about 10 years ago, it was recommended that all patients with hypercoagulable states should stay on anticoagulation lifelong. But now, depending on the patient, where their thrombosis was, you need to have, and it's a hard talk to have with patients about how long they should stay on anticoagulation. So it depends on the serious nature. If they've got bilateral pulmonary emboli that put them in the intensive care unit, I kind of think no matter what they're testing for hypercoagulable state is, that they should probably be on it lifelong. A lower extremity DVT with a hypercoagulable state other than lupus anticoagulant, you may, be able to stop it at some point, 3, 6 months or a year. But the lupus anticoagulant, they should stay on it indefinitely unless they revert to negative. So these are some things you got to think about for lifelong anticoagulation. And some more issues. So patient preference is a big thing, and also how compliant they are. So I had one patient who did have a hypercoagulable state, and he had an extensive DVT in his leg. But for fun, on the weekends, he and his buddies would do Marine boot camp. Well, it's really kind of hard to be on an anticoagulant and doing boot camp. So, you know, we had the discussion, and he felt more comfortable stopping. There's some patients who want to stay on it for comfort. Another hard discussion to have with patients is if they have residual thrombosis in their leg, which many of them are going to have. It does increase your risk for getting another blood clot. So sometimes you can stop it, knowing that if they get another blood clot, then you have to have the discussion all over again. It's just hard to know what's the right thing for each patient. But I think open conversation and the trust that your patient has with you will help a lot. So that's the end of this section. And we'll take questions at lunchtime, or if you see me in between time, we'll be glad to try to answer your questions. Thank you.